Hello and welcome back to the Lead Generation for Financial Services podcast. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about ditching our imps, which are not fair. I've planned this before. I'm not sure it's going to, if people, when I hear the word imp, I think of like a medieval creature.
Yeah, well, they're living in your head.
Ah, right, because I was going to do an intro about a joke about it. It's not, they're not medieval creatures. It's imposter syndromes.
It's imposter syndrome. It's the imps in your head, those gremlins that stop us from taking the action that we're actually really excited to be taking.
Yeah, so you have used the kind of play on words, yeah, actually used the original meaning of the word imp. You are potentially the cleverest person we've had on the podcast.
Well, if that's what it takes, then I'm very, very honoured. Actually, because of my lazy shorthand, when I was writing Ditching Imposter Syndrome last year, I got really fed up of writing Ditching Imposter Syndrome. So I wrote DIMPS, and it just came from there. It's just like Ditch Your Imps was my shorthand for the book, and it stuck.
Fantastic. I should probably introduce you properly, shouldn't I?
If you want.
Claire, and then do you know what? I've been listening to your podcast this morning, so I know how to pronounce your name, yet I feel like I'm over it.
So
I'm gonna Yosa. Yeah, I know that. And I pause some reason. Claire Yosa, who you gave me your book called Ditching Imposter Syndrome. I've just Instagram storied the note that you read, you wrote for me.
I wasn't rich, was I?
No, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. So you don't remember what you put? Do you want me to? I'll read it out for you.
I remember some of it, but you're going to need to read it back to me because that was last November.
That was last November. We are recording now in early February 2020. It says, "Dear Alex, may this book inspire you to create the miracles you're here to share."
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That is one of the most beautiful things anyone's ever written to me. Aww, I don't get written things often, but still, it's only one of five things that people have ever written to me, but it's number one.
Yeah.
Ah, and you've got some big names. So Ian Anderson Gray, who was on our table, has written the testimonial from her, who was speaking on stage the year before.
Yes.
Do you remember that we were sat on that table at that event, and I got called up on stage and I had to sit next to someone who was talking about how they've just been invited to Necker Island and they had this amazing year working for Richard Branson. And then Chris goes on to me and I said to you, that was the first time I think in my life I've had imposter syndrome. I think I need a copy of your book.
There you go. And you got the last one that I took me.
I know. I stole it off. Was it? I think. Was it?
It might. It might say, "Sorry, Ian."
Yes.
He had to buy his own copy. Clearing out those hidden fears, I call it the flinch factor. Yeah. So it's where you know that you've got to do something, and there's that physical kind of the body contracts. Yeah. If you think about something right now that you've been avoiding doing, and there'll be something when you think about it, the body will kind of go, "Ooh." And I'm not talking like housework cleaning-y stuff. I'm talking about stuff that requires you to stretch your comfort zone. And that flinch in the body is an early warning sign of fear that means that there is an internal dialogue going on of, "I'm scared to do this."
I think a lot of people get this, and I know I did, because I try and encourage our guys, brokers, anyone in financial services to get on things like video and sort of put themselves kind of out of their comfort zone. And I think like, I assume that's a common place where people feel fear about all sorts of things. How do I look? What am I going to say? If I say something wrong, there must be all sorts of kind of twitches.
There are. So when you're running your own business, imposter syndrome, and one of the settling statistics we found, try and say that after a glass of wine, is in the entrepreneurial world, the proportion of respondents who said they were struggling with imposter syndrome daily or regularly was 82%. 82% in the entrepreneurial world. And it's even more so when your business is about you rather than about a widget. Because if you get a no or you get a rejection, then it feels personal and we judge ourselves. Whereas if someone doesn't want to buy your widget, they don't like the widget. If they don't want to buy your services, then we tell ourselves they don't like us. And that's not actually true. Normally, most people have to have a caveat in there, but it can really. And imposter syndrome is essentially the being found out is not good enough. The fear of, who am I to be doing this? Who am I to charge that much? Who am I to stand on that stage to market my services? Who am I to speak up at a networking event? Or you see somebody who might need your services and you don't say anything because it's like I don't want to bother them. It's all those times we hold back from being 100% the CEO of a successful business.
Does everyone, what a ridiculous question, does everyone suffer from imposter syndrome? But like 82%, what do you reckon these other percentage must have maybe have had it before and then have obviously overcome it or?
So if the remaining 18, so I'm just proving I can do a little bit of math, a lot of them were having it less regularly than regularly. So a lot of them, it was sometimes or occasionally, rarely. Very few entrepreneurs had never had it. But I do know some who simply don't get it. And they people who switch their emotions off about their business and they don't take it personally. And it makes them very, very successful because they don't sit there for half an hour thinking, oh, I don't want to phone that lead because what if they think I'm into a day or, you know, what if I get a no? They just go and take the action. And if it doesn't work that time, they look at what they need to learn and they take the next action. So actually, to be a successful business owner with imposter syndrome, I think you deserve a great big badge. As a business owner, we deserve actually acknowledgement because we've got this extra hurdle to get over. But the brilliant news, you don't have to be stuck with it. And the first stage to setting yourself free is simply noticing that that was an imposter syndrome thought. Do I actually want this to be making my major business decisions or not?
So obviously, first step, noticing it, and then do people just naturally get over it? I assume you've got some kind of, procedures.
I have got a process now. So I've been specializing in this for the last 15 years with high achievers, so business leaders and entrepreneurs. And what I've found is we all have the most incredible coping strategies. So people don't spontaneously normally get over it, but they might move to a different role where it doesn't be more. So they might find it then disappears. There is stuff you can consciously do to clear it. But one of the challenges is because we're so good at coping and hiding it, that we go into denial about whether we've got it. As I say, the first stage is, okay, these thoughts are imposter syndrome. And they're the kind of things you'll find yourself doing if you're running a business is you'll be discounting your fee before even being asked. You leave it slightly too long to return that call on a comfort zone stretch project. You might apologize when you're talking to people. You know, I'm really sorry, it's going to have to be this. Coming from that back foot the whole time, you might have a brilliant idea and not implement it. Convince yourself that you're too busy or it's not the right time. This kind of thing. And it's thinking about your audience, Alex. How them? So if you're somebody listening right now.
Oh, God, talking fees, definitely. When they say, you know, it's to arrange this mortgage or whatever, it's £500. And maybe some of them may think, oh, but then they might think, I'll just go online. And I presume a lot of them will, with definitely turning up and giving advice because on not giving advice, but doing the marketing, because they're all essentially selling the same thing. The only thing that is unique about their service is them. And what they kind of do, a you know, niche in a particular product or not. But you take the average whole of market broker, there's two in the town, and they're both in the same network. What they have access to is exactly that. So I presume with some of them, it comes out there. But yeah, definitely, you know, some of them will do face-to-face appointments, I guess, especially early on in the career, definitely. I suppose with any kind of sales or advice role, that could come out. But especially talking fees, if someone has never used a broker, there's a fee. Or, yeah, so definitely I'm picking out those two situations.
Yeah. So yeah, it's incredibly common. And what I've found is that when somebody goes to run their own business and be self-employed, that it can crank it up. Because in a corporate environment, you've got your appraisals, you've got the team around you to bounce ideas off, to get, you know, the water cooler moments of, I'm feeling like this. Is that normal? You know, there is a support network. There is a feedback structure. And when you're running your own business, that disappears and you become every single role in the company. And it's really easy for imposter syndrome to take over. And it's one of the biggest triggers I find for businesses that are not growing at the rate you would expect them to grow.
I found having a mentor and a like little mastermind group. So I just had one this morning. So there's five of us, like entrepreneurs, some of us similar businesses that because yeah, especially, but I do remember like being a freelancer for 6 months we had a spare bedroom upstairs and that was my office. And I would not talk to anyone other than clients about business. And you don't like you say, you don't have, whereas now, you know, ring up my mentor or one of my kind of mastermind buddies and say, and they'll, what you're, like you said earlier, you kind of already know, but sometimes you do need that push to be like, and I was probably doing it for someone else. He was chasing invoices off, and I was like, why haven't you done like set the process early and take the money early at the beginning of the month rather. And it's stuff that mentor used to say to me. So yeah, it is definitely quite lonely on your own.
It can be. And over the years, so I've been doing this for 17 years this year. It makes me feel really old.
You not look old enough. Definitely.
I got used to being 35 last week and I was really thrilled. One of the things I found is it sounds like you're in a really positive mastermind and you've got a really great mentor. You need people who will tell you it like it is rather than just people who build you up and lift your mood and make you believe you can do anything rather than criticizing you. And I've been in both over the years. I've been in a mastermind that ended up as a gossip shop of negativity. Just dragged each other down. It's really important to choose your mentor and to choose your mastermind wisely and to know what you want from it and to find people that are in different game to you, so you're not all at the same level, and ideally in different industries so you can bounce ideas off each other.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, quite a few little masterminds, actually. One's like, it was this one from this morning, is the only one where I've got another agency owner with like bricks and mortar office. Because, you know, a lot of people in the community outsource everything, and a lot of people sort of work either, you know, they'll travel around the, you know, around the world to do the beach lap style. But yeah, that variety and then definitely tells me how it is without saying, without, you know, giving me an order. You know, it's your choice, but this is what I did. I reckon you should be doing this and this.
Absolutely. That's the purpose of a mentor rather than a coach. As a mentor, will tell you the shortcuts. The coach is only allowed to ask you the questions to help you find the answers inside of, which can be a really slow route.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
My mentor, that just happened. Like, he was donating his time at our local business center. I just rocked up and we got on. I didn't even know I needed a mentor. So and where do you go to? Because I haven't paid him a penny as well. I would feel weird. Not that I'm against investing in like it, but I would find it like, I'm probably straying off subject a bit, but I'd find it a bit weird, like where their motivations are coming from if I'm paying them. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. So, you know, looking for a mentor, I would be looking for people in my network whose businesses have had a breakthrough and looking who helped them. Because I'm not interested in a mentor with a glossy sales page and the patter. I want somebody who's worked with people I know well enough to ask them about it, where I look at it and I can see the difference the mentor's made to their business.
That is a great point.
And it's rare. It's quite rare. There are a lot of people paying a fortune for mentoring that doesn't work.
One interesting, we had a guy on the podcast earlier this year. He's grown a business up to like 45 advisors. And we had one of his advisors on and he saw the boss as his mentor. And that guy's always hiring. So like, that's a great way of finding. And we've had people on the podcast who have sold businesses and in this space that have done it. So yeah, that is a great, I've never really thought about it that way, looking at someone who's fallen, looking at that. Yeah,
exactly. So I wouldn't be hiring the person whose business grew. I'd be finding out who they worked with.
Yeah, nice. Yeah,
that's your shortcut to finding somebody who actually knows how to teach this stuff. Because one of the things I've found over the years in the industry I'm in the whole personal development field and leadership development, is a lot of people are great at what they do, but they don't understand how they do it well enough to be able to teach that to others. And I've certainly seen it in the business world where you get the latest guru saying, hey, here's my multi-four-figure program to make a squidillion pounds in half a nanosecond. It only works for about three people who signed up. And what happens is the guru then blames everybody else. It's, well, you can't have implemented it properly because the fact they had success means it works. But actually, there might be things in the mindset and the inner blocks and the strategy that this person doesn't realize were part of their magic and so hasn't included. So you really do need to pay attention and look at who's getting results and how.
So how did you get into this then for you? Was this a battle for you back in the day or someone you know, or what kind of interests you on the subject?
So my original background is I've got a master's degree in mechanical engineering in German.
Right. Yeah, we've all got one of those, yeah.
So I'm proof that career change works. And after a long time in engineering, specializing in Six Sigma and lean manufacturing, I decided actually I wanted to know how people ticked instead of machines. So I went traveling for a year and came back and became head of market research at one of the UK's most disruptive brands, studied psychology, became an NLP trainer. So that's like the user manual for your brain. And then there came a point where I wanted to do more of the development work with, and that wasn't going to work inside that role. So I left in 2003 and set up my own business and have not looked back. And I'm very unemployable now. And I'm sure lots of people listening to this right now resonate with that. It's the idea of ever having to go back to a job where someone tells me what I've got to do.
I know.
I'm like, no, that's
not happening. Yeah. I would struggle. I would definitely struggle. And I know, I've met a lot of brokers as well in this industry who are like, wish they'd done it sooner.
My very first executive mentoring client had what I later discovered was called imposter syndrome. The next one, and then the next one, and then the next one. And I look back at my own career and I vividly remember the points at which I realized I had it too, though I still didn't know it had a name. And it was that classic. I was successful. I was on the fast track for promotion. And I was one of only two female engineers in my factory on a staff of 200 engineers, having a cup of tea in a quiet space in the old factory where they'd taken machines out with my fellow engineer, female engineer, and just having to come clean because I'd been lying awake at 3 o'clock in the morning every day. What if they find me out? What if they realize I'm not as good as they think I am? What if today is the day that my luck runs out? That whole Icarus effect, yeah? And I came clean and I just said to her, I just don't know what to do. This is how I'm feeling every night at 3 a.m. and it's really affecting my health. And she just stood there and she looked at me. She said, you too. And I was like, whoa, okay, it's not just me. And this is one of the things that I find when I work with people on imposter syndrome, that breakthrough to realize you're not alone. You're not a freak. There's nothing broken. And actually, you can do something about this. That is the most powerful thing.
When you've worked with people, then is it different for every person? Then where are you kind of getting the kind of the best breakthroughs with people, and what kind of differences is that having in people that you've worked with?
So the process that I really work with, if I'm going with a one-to-one client, then obviously they just get the bits they need. It's tailored to their needs. But when I decoded my sausage machine, so I put the old I did the Six Sigma kind of process reverse engineering combined with the NLP trainer designing a training course to create the book so that I would have something that was standalone. That's what I call pajama ready. So if somebody's had a long day and they're reading it in bed at night, it still works for them. Yeah. Because frankly, I don't want to be sat there having to talk to them. And I think most people would have somebody with them that might object. And this 5-step process, it starts with clearing out the myths about imposter syndrome, because the unconscious mind won't let you make a change that it believes is impossible. And the majority of people believe that imposter syndrome is incurable. They believe it's inevitable. They often believe that it's a sign of, achievement and success and growth, and we should be proud of it. And there was an editor for a national magazine in Australia last year who did a huge feature on it saying, I've got imposter syndrome and I'm keeping it because it means I've made it. And I thought, great. So you've made it, but you feel miserable, and you could have made it and just not feel miserable. So you clear out the myths, which then creates the space for hope. So step two is then taming the inner critic. And that is that voice in the head. Those are the imps. That's learning how to press pause on the self-talk that causes us to self-sabotage, often without even realizing. And it's not about papering over the cracks and pretending that positive thinking is going to work. It's about rewiring the neural pathways in your brain, which is all thoughts are. The filters in the brain that show us what to pay attention to that we've programmed through our habitual thoughts is changing those so that your inner critic starts to become your cheerleader in a really healthy way, which is really cool. Three is then clearing out the hidden blocks and fears. So that's the limiting beliefs, the excuses, the fears, the worries. And I love clearing out the root causes on those. And by that, I mean below the surface rather than the conscious stuff, because when you do that, it's a lot easier than it sounds. And then all those crazy behaviors we have on the surface just disappear. Yeah, and that confidence then becomes genuine. Step four is where we get down to that identity level, because that's the big thing that the research study showed last year. And the identity level is the whole, who am I? I am not good enough. Any statement in your self-talk that's got an I am in means you've taken that feedback and made it personal, the identity level. So we clear that stuff out. We work on taking off the hidden masks that we all put on, the armor, so you can actually show up as all of who you really are, rather than feeling that you have to take an alter ego to work with you. And the other big thing there is dialing back on self-judgment, because I often talk about imposter syndrome being the fear of others judging us the way we judge ourselves. So the less you're judging yourself, the less you're going to be scared that others are judging you. And it helps you to detach from that whole praise versus criticism, feedback, fear cycle that so many of us are in, where we only feel as good as the last compliment that we got. And that last compliment we dismiss anyway as luck or fluke, or they're just being nice. And then step five is the final stage, which is really stepping up to become the leader you were born to be. Because if you're running a business or if you're in a company, you will be leading somebody somewhere in some way. It's really about recreating your vision for who you want to become in life without the baggage. Because what you want and who you want to be will subtly change when you're no longer carrying the suitcases of imposter syndrome. Does that make sense?
It's fascinating. I'm just trying to, like, I'm always obviously being selfish in these interviews of thinking how, where am I at in this stage? And kind of one thing, like, so I don't worry if, I can't explain how I've got over that or if I, no, I definitely did had the LinkedIn for a long time. I was afraid to put stuff on LinkedIn. I was safe in videos in my office. So I was safe doing them in my Facebook group that I'm the kind of the admin of, and I, you know, I've got the power, if you like, to delete something if someone put something that I didn't like, which I've never had to do, thankfully, and everyone's very lovely. But now I don't care, like, if someone challenged me on LinkedIn, what I maybe used to be scared of before, but I cannot tell you how I got to that position.
Yeah.
I have no idea what I did or what happened. I just did it, I think.
And that's great. Because sometimes these breakthroughs will happen spontaneously. And sometimes we grow into being the version of us that's ready for that next stage of the journey.
Hmm.
And that can happen in the background, or it can happen with conscious support and intervention. But the key is imposter syndrome is only an issue if being a gap between who we think we are and who we think we need to be to create something or to achieve something. And that gap, I call it the imposter syndrome gap.
I was listening to the podcast this morning I was listening to the one you were talking about, the Gary Vee and the hustle. And
yeah, and I love Gary Vee. I hate hustle. Mm. It's just me. One of my words for the year this year is unhustle. Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of my work is in the online space, and I just found myself spending so much time on social media, on opt-in stuff, on newsletters, the lot. So I made myself a promise that in 2020, I was going to cut my online time by 90%, which felt quite scary because my business really depended on it. And that I was going to focus more time on face-to-face stuff, specifically paid speaking gigs. So all I did was do an unofficial silent sabbatical from social media, set up my speaker page, and I've already got 9 paid speaking gigs for this year. And it's only, as we record this, it's February, beginning of February. This is what, you know, and I've had 2 more leads even today. So what's happened is because I've taken back the hustle and the energy I was using to hustle, that's created space for me to actually be able to receive these requests and do something with them and turn them into contracts. So I've unhustled and my business is growing faster than if I had spent 60 hour weeks hustling. And I'm not suggesting if you're listening to this, you should just sit back and do nothing.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Oh, well, that was going to be my next question. Like, so you made it sound very, very easy.
Yeah, well, I decided to drop the bit that wasn't actually generating me leads of people who were ready to be helped. Because what the hub was generating me lots of leads of people who weren't ready to invest in themselves or in their businesses. And it was keeping my energy saturated in the online space, which is not where my personal clients were hanging out. Yeah. Because I work mainly with business leaders and business owners who most of them do not have time to be on Facebook and LinkedIn 5 hours a day. And when I did that and I started working on my network instead, that is producing me so many more leads. So my invitation would be to everyone to look at what is taking up the majority of your time. What is the motivation behind that? Is it that someone said, this is how you've got to do it? And is it actually working? And if it's not working, which bits are working? And how could you flip the 90-10 or the 80-20 so that you can do more of what's working rather than one of the major symptoms of imposter syndrome, filling your time with busyness, which is what I was kind of doing. Because I'd got into this 15 years online of you've got to hustle. My time was completely filled with busyness that was not producing results. I took out the busyness and the results are coming.
What's interesting, very, very different kind of situation, but I met a guy who is a mortgage advisor, does financial planning and all sorts of things as well. He's got five admin staff for him himself, as in other people who hiring more advisors but don't have one full-time admin person. And they are, and I know some that stay very busy doing. He's obviously had that same kind of conversation with himself as you had. Where am I most effective? Having to sit down with the clients, intro, blah, 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 and passing it on to my paraplan or whatever. And he wrote like a lot of business last year. Like he was the highest earning single advisor in the whole network. So similar sort of thing. He's done it on the sales thing rather than the, well, so same sort of thing. So he's like, where's the money? Where am I most effective? And gone for it. And yeah, from what I sense from him, there was no kind of imposter syndrome or like anything going on there with him. But he's been doing it for about the same sort of time as you. So I assume he didn't do this from day one. So I guess if people are thinking, I need to change everything tomorrow, it's not a flick of the switch, is it, I guess?
There are things that would be easy to change and easy to test, you know. And the main thing is, if you're running your own business, you do need to make sure you've still got income coming in. That doesn't mean you can't play, you can't experiment. And I've definitely found that for me, the online world, with having to be visible everywhere all the time, was just not working and it was draining my energy. Speaking events I'm booked for already this year, I know are going to put me in front of my absolute dream audience who are not hanging out on LinkedIn and Facebook. And they're not going to respond to cold pitches. But one of the things I've found is that the speaking for me is really working, because when I've done one event, I can guarantee that I will book at least one or two more from people in the audience at that first event. And it opens the conversations then for bigger training projects within their business or for coaching consultancy. There will be things that it's not our job to do. Yeah. You know, having an admin person who's brilliant at the attention to detail, if you're great at creating that client relationship and understanding what their needs are, a lot of us don't also then combine that with the nitty gritty detail you need to get, say, a mortgage application through in time for a house to be bought. So have somebody on the team, find somebody that you can have maybe 10 hours a week, you know, a couple of hours a day, who could work remotely and experiment, try it for 3 months. You know, most of us would have the budget to be able to afford that. And if you don't, set it as a goal, is what could I delegate that would allow me to spend more time on the genius I bring to my business rather than the grunt work that, frankly, somebody else would probably do much better than me, because they enjoy it. Yeah. If I look at gardening, we live on a small holding and we've got a really large veg patch. And you won't be surprised by this, Alex. I am the girl that likes to go out there and do the big scale stuff. You know, I'm happy to plant the seed. I like the, I'm creating and I'm planting the plants out. And my husband, luckily, likes the bit I hate, which is the weeding. I hate weeding. He finds it really satisfying, clearing a patch and making sure every last root of whatever nasty is out. So we make a really great team. But if I had to do the weeding, my plants would die because I wouldn't do it properly. And I'd have to spend a lot more energy looking after my plants. If he had to do the seed sowing, the transplanting, all of that, the plants would die because he doesn't hold it in his head how these things need to work and when they need to be done. And it's the same in any business. We have our strengths. We have the bits that we do because we had to when we were one-man bands. There's always somebody that is absolutely desperate to do the kind of work we don't enjoy, because actually it brings them joy.
I just cannot agree more. I'm literally going through the same sort of thing myself. My mastermind crew keep telling me off for spending too much time on things like the podcast, doing the like editing-y bits that what I'm doing actually, I haven't got it set up now, but when I do have it set up, when we've stopped recording, that will automatically, because we're using Zencastr, create a Dropbox folder, and then I'll set up a zap when there is a new folder in there that will create a task on our Asana, and then that will be assigned to that person, and then the chain goes off. So then I literally don't touch anything other than the microphone and the record on and off, which is what I should have been doing from day one.
But you see, we get in this mindset, don't we, when we're running a business, if you have to do everything at first, and then we find it really hard to let go.
Yeah, we totally do.
You know, and for me, this is why it is about hiring the stars. You don't skimp on your support staff. You don't get the person that's going to cost you more in time to help them do what you're asking them to do than it would have cost you to do it. Hire the people who live and breathe that stuff. And if they don't have the training to do what you need them to do, then you need to decide whether you want to pay for that training or look for someone else.
I felt like when I was freelancing, I had all these different skills and I felt like, oh, I need like 10 people with individual skills. When actually, yeah, I was like, I saw that as a bad thing, but actually it's a good thing. Like getting these people really good and really passionate about that one thing. Well, I've definitely kissed a few frogs on the way.
Me too.
But you do get there. It's not easy, but when you do get there, it is. And then you suppose as well, it's that tough thing because you need the cash flow as well. Dead about making a plan. Exactly what I did. And then my mentor said to me on the first time I ever met him, the last thing he said to me was like, get a plan effing job, because at work I was all over the place. So putting those plans in place to get the people that you need to do what you're amazing at. Maybe that's helped me with my fear thing as well. I don't know.
Because I found that there's one sector of the working population that had the lowest rates of imposter syndrome, which quite surprised me. Those stats I got that I really kept just double checking. Actually, startups at between 5 and 20 employees. There's something that happens about having that startup energy and having people around you who are supporting the project, who believe in you, who are having ideas that are better than you and I can have on our own. It didn't have that fear. I mean, you've then got the fear of, yes, of course, I've got to keep the business running and pay everybody's salary. But the imposter syndrome, that was the lowest rate in the entire working population.
Weirdly, I totally get that. And it doesn't surprise me the way you kind of frame that with that startup mentality, getting the right people, you're all pulling in, you got a clear vision. Makes a lot of sense. Have we not talked about anything we should? Is my default question when I'm not sure if we have or not.
I think the most important thing I'd like to say to you listening is that everyone listening to the show today is, you can do this. Yeah, if you want to be doing this, if you want to do it rather than you fell into it, but if you want to do it and you're getting the results your clients want, then one of the really big things I used over the years when I used to have imposter syndrome was I would flip my why for what I was doing. So instead of my why being about me, I want to run a business and I need to have this turnover because that person on social media had a glossy post saying that you're not a success unless you do. It was all very personal and imposter syndrome would play a lot. When I swapped it over and said, okay, I'm doing this thing that feels a bit scary because of the result my audience is going to get. Yeah. So this is not about, I'm doing it for them. And I had that breakthrough about 5 years ago when I co-led the EU VAT action campaign on digital VAT and we got EU law changed. And there were so many points in that campaign. There was a group of us who were volunteers, two of us co-led it. You know, I had to give keynotes at the European Parliament. We had to have stand-up rows in Downing Street. Regularly fighting with HMRC and HM Treasury, trying to get these laws changed and having to win people round. And when I say fighting, I mean just more saying no, actually.
Yeah, not fisticuffs.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And whenever we thought we couldn't do it, I would just flip it round. Is okay, I've had 50 people now in government tell us that this is impossible and we should give up. I'm not giving up because there are 10,000 businesses out there that we're directly working with, probably 100,000 in the UK alone that were affected, and we're doing this for them. And every time I flipped that round, my doubt and my self-judgment disappeared because it was no longer about me. It was about the difference for my customers. So if you're looking at something like financial services, say being a mortgage broker, it's not about me selling my mortgage broking services. It's about me helping that person to get the house they've been dreaming of when somebody else has already told them they can't have it.
Okay, so I think found out why I don't have imposter syndrome and may have had it before because I did exactly the same thing. My why was about my family, make enough money to support them. And then now my why is I don't want anyone in financial services to stress about where the next deal is coming from. No benefit for me, but has like way more since doing that. That's mega interesting.
That flipping your why. Yeah. And the other side of it, I've now got this why. Who do I need to allow myself to become to live and breathe that why?
That's incredible. I think I may have done it already. I'm so brilliant. Check me out. And even in my book, it's one of the things that I tell people to do. I didn't know why I was telling them to do it. Now I do. So I might have to edit the book and reference you on that one. I call it being selfishly unselfish.
Yeah. And it's very much not about that whole noble thing. It's got to be something that your body agrees with. Because if we're saying something to ourselves and the body disagrees, then it means the unconscious mind disagrees and it will sabotage.
And I remember stressing about where I'm coming from. And I was like, I just don't want anyone to feel that way for their business. And that's what I'm going to try and solve.
Exactly.
Amazing. We have chatted for 40 minutes. It feels like 30 seconds. I'm going to have to wrap it up or you're going to send me an invoice, aren't you? Because now you're speaking gigs that if you might have a clause in your contract, if it goes over 42 minutes, it's this is how much I charge.
No, I'm really happy to do podcast interviews as a gift, as you know. And actually, yeah. I also do unpaid speaking gigs for charities and local organisations and that kind of thing. People who genuinely don't have the funds. But I'm really strict now. It's a business event and people are being charged for the ticket to enter and you're paying venue hire, then you pay the speakers too.
But I've got an event that contradicts such methodologies. So just to let everyone know, I don't think Claire's going to be speaking at one of our conferences in the future.
We're talking about the corporate world here, which is different. You and I both, in the entrepreneurial world, we help each other out, yeah?
Well, there we go. The news flash, everyone, Claire may be speaking at our next conference. We've gone from one end to the other, so watch this space.
You've got a big corporate conference and people are being £2,000 to attend.
No, ours is like £100 and we make zero pence off it. Incredible. You've got other books as well, haven't you? I forgot. Is it the Happy? Oh, no, I should remember this.
You don't have to remember. I've got 6 books basically on how to change the world by changing yourself. And I've got 2 novels because I got bored of writing nonfiction, which I'm so pleased. They've both been described as unput down by readers, which is a dream come true. And the 3rd novel in the trilogy will probably come out at Christmas.
Wow. So literally, if you have fallen in love with Claire, there's literally an endless amount of content that you consume.
I think that's probably about right, actually.
I know. And you've got the podcast as well that launched this year, right?
Yeah. So I've got the Ditch Your Imps podcast, and I've also got Revolutionary Women, which is aimed at women who love the way their industry works and make a bigger difference in the world and get out of their own way to be able to do that.
I remember you talking to me about this. So literally, I'm going to put all the links in the show notes. You'll get to meet Claire in October of this year at our next event. I just want to arrange that. Thank you so much. This was great. Being Selfishly Unselfish, I've had a massive breakthrough for me. And I'm sure that I literally got a message the other day from someone saying, they sent me a video saying the podcast already helped them build their confidence and things like this. I'm pretty sure this particular episode will bring about more breakthroughs. So for anyone else, I will try and get Claire into our Facebook group as well. But if not, if you've got any nice messages, if this has helped you, I'm sure you'd love to see it, right?
That would be wonderful. It'd be really lovely to hear from people.
Fantastic. All right then. I'll speak to you soon. In fact, in 2 minutes about negotiating speaking opportunities. Bye-bye.